Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. UN Human Rights Chief Volker Türk on Wednesday condemned serious sexual violations allegedly carried out by Hamas militants during their terror attacks in southern Israel on the 7th of October. Humanitarians helping Gazans, meanwhile, said that conditions for civilians there had hit rock bottom amid continued bombardment and mass displacement in the south. In Geneva, UN High Commissioner Türk said it was painfully clear that the atrocious attacks should be fully and independently investigated, and that his office had issued requests to Israel so that this could happen.
It is clear atrocious forms of sexual violence need to be thoroughly investigated, and we need to make sure that justice is served, because that's what we owe the victims.
The UN rights chief also expressed deep concern at the catastrophic scenes playing out in Gaza since Israeli Defense Forces began their retaliation for the Hamas-led terror attack on the 7th of October. Those concerns were echoed by UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, which said that it was getting constant SOS calls from colleagues and friends in Gaza. To Myanmar, where the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has condemned the unbearable toll of the 2021 military coup and subsequent brutal crackdown on civilians. Volker Türk cited credible sources who say that military forces have killed over 4,200 civilians since the 1st of February putsch. He said that civilians had suffered countless violations, including airstrikes, artillery shelling, enforced disappearances, sexual violence, and the burning of their homes, fields and villages. The UN rights chief added that the perilous situation of Rohingya Muslims was still unresolved, with no prospect of safe and sustainable return, a situation that continues to force many to risk their lives on dangerous sea journeys. COP28 news now from Dubai, where the UN climate chief said on Wednesday that delegates were not there to score points, as he urged them to take ambitious action on curbing global warming. Simon Steele's call to government negotiators comes halfway through the latest UN climate conference. So far, no agreement has been reached on financing for climate adaptation or the fate of fossil fuels. Adding its voice to the call for urgent action, the UN Migration Agency, IOM, highlighted how climate adaptation measures are needed in Iraq. It says that a tidal wave of salty seawater is inching northwards and already destroying countless palm groves, citrus trees and other agricultural crops in Iraq's southernmost governorate, Basra. Further north in Tikar governorate, IOM warned that marshes are drying up because of several factors, including a lack of rain, the construction of dams by Iraq's neighbors, and the absence of sustainably managed water resources locally. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County.
I want all privately owned radios to be immediately impounded.
Yes, sir.
Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Kansas.
Well, there is such a place, Trevor.
There must be. It's not a place you can get to by a boat or a train. It's far, far away. Behind the moon. Beyond the rain.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have an announcement.
I can no longer sit back and allow the conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Let's talk about
creeping like a communist. It's knocking at our doors, voraciously devouring the way things are today. Savagely deflowering the
official story.
Radio Free Kansas.
Madness.
Radio Free Kansas.
Madness.
Why should you put your hands, G.I.?
Now, why don't you just take it easy? Please make me a drink of grain alcohol and rainwater and help yourself to whatever you'd like.
Radio Free Kansas out of North Jefferson County, Kansas.
Kansas.
Ear to the ground, voice in the air worldwide.
Well, that's it, boys. I've been redeemed.
Radio Free Kansas.
Done washed away all my sins and transgressions.
You can listen in.
Radio Free Kansas.
Mr. Olson, would you play something for Eddie? Do that, will you? I may look simple, but I want you to know I'm full of knowledge. I'm right at home with brainy men, and then my wisdom I show. But when there's clever girls around, I get up and go. Those educated babies are a bore. I'm going to say what I've said many times before. Oh, the dumber they come, the better I like them, because the dumb ones know how to make love. Oh, Weisenheimer has you meet her folks when you call. The brainless baby always keeps you down in the hall. Oh, the dumbbells I've met have won beauty prizes. They look like angels sent from above. A clever girl will want to know if you mean to wed. The dumb ones never think of looking that far ahead. That's why the dumber they come, the better I like them, because the dumb ones know how to make love. Oh, the dumber they come, the better I like them, because the dumb ones know how to make love. The smart girls speak Greek and other languages too, but the dumb girls only languages whose poochie-poochie is you. All the sets that I've met have won beauty prizes. They look like angels sent from above. You start on squeezing clever girls, you're soon on the shelf. But when you're with dumb daughters, you can just be yourself. All the dumber they come, the better I like them.
You know, trying to do a live show out here, it's like, even when you're predictable, you can still be predictable and people are like, I don't give a fuck. I don't listen to it. I'm not going to listen to it. I don't give a fuck. I mean, oh, hey, by the way, it's noon. I just thought I'd stop by. I mean, I just thought I'd stop by when I know you're doing a live show. Hey, I just wanted to stop by and say I'm leaving now. I see you're doing a live show. I mean, it's... We got a new text cast. A new text cast today. Yep. Well, actually 2 days ago. And who knows what Naomi Fowler, the host, is going to come up with. Network. I mean, you never know. You absolutely do not know. You know, they're famous for tracking down some rich bastards that don't pay taxes and ditches. I mean, it ain't like nowadays we don't have bitch billionaires. You know, we got bastard billionaires, bitch billionaires. I mean, it's just nonstop. I mean, the way the news media and the Kardashians and the Paris Hiltons and the, you know, why the news is reported, you'd think there's a goddamn billionaire under every bush. I mean, they're just everywhere. Nothing but goddamn billionaires, I'm telling you. Oh, man. Mm-mm-mm. Podunkville, that's where I come from. And I don't know what to tell you, man. Here's one. One more. Well, let's play a set of old songs, and I promise they won't last 10 minutes. All right? 10 minutes. And then we got to go into the programs. Law and Disorder in the first hour and in the second hour. A brand new text cast, which came out in November. It's now December, but yeah, we got a new text cast. I don't know. I don't know if I want to stick in the 20s today. I don't feel like we're in the roaring 20s. Today I got a problem, you know? I do. I just got to pick it up a little bit. It's Thursday. We got to pick it up. You know, pick it up. Pick it up, mofo. Pick it up, mofo, man. It's just there, right there. We got to pick it up somehow, man. It's Thursday. We're going on Friday. Friday. Huh. Just laying there on the ground. Pick it up, mofo. Pick it up. Pick up your earbud. Dig your earbuds out of the crack of your car seat and listen in. This is Podunkville, mofo. Pick it up. We've got Rusty on the line. Now, listen, I actually have several callers, but, and I don't.
We only got about 10 minutes, folks. 10 minutes.
But you got to punch one. Rusty caught on to that. He punched one to get in the green room. Let's see what Rusty got to say. Go ahead, Rusty. What's up, man? You're on the air.
Oh, thanks for having me. I just want to get your thoughts on Mike Johnson.
I think he should be stuck in a 300-foot or cubic, I guess, something. That, you know, that yacht, that ark, which is actually a multi-million dollar scam to get the people who think that the, you know, the new earth is a 6,000-year-old earth, the biblical fundamentalist, you know, to go in a, at a tourist trap. I think it's in Kentucky or West Virginia. I don't know where the hell it's at, somewhere in the deep south. I mean, that's what kind of guy he is. He should be the barker out in front telling people, come on, we used to ride dinosaurs. Look, they're all on the ark here with the dinosaurs. And it's only 6,000 years old. Come on, we can get through it. You know, this guy is so unqualified.
So you're not a fan of Mike, you're not a fan of Mike Johnson?
No, I'm not a fan of people who actually use that kind of creationist crap to really bamboozle the old people out here in Podunkville, of which I'm one of them. I'm an old guy. But, I mean, it's like I can see it. It's like people watch Fox News parade around out here, and they, well, I guess I better go for Mike, what's his name, Johnson, Speaker of Johnson, because, he, you know, he talks like us. I mean, we're acceptable. I mean, you know, it's an acceptable kind of creed out here, and it's not acceptable. Everybody knows it's, you know, you're either being bamboozled and you believe it, or you just want to get along to be at the next ice cream social. You don't want people talking shit about you behind your back. That's what
it's
all about.
Well, it just seems like. It seems like everybody's tickled by Mike Johnson.
Well, I mean, he's coming. Where is he coming from? Help me out. Help the audience out. What state does he come from? Come on.
Oh, he's coming from Mike Johnson.
Yeah,
what's coming?
He representing? Yeah, what does he represent?
Louisiana.
Oh, yeah, that would explain a lot. I wonder what part of Louisiana. I mean, it could be anything. I mean. That is, I mean, just look at it. I mean, it's next to Mississippi. I mean, it's it's a hellscape. Certain parts of the state, I guess the wildlife area is a hellscape.
I don't know if you noticed, my Johnson's kind of a stiff, you know, when it gets worked up, my Johnson's veins start to bulge. Have you seen that?
No, I stopped vein watching with Yul Brynner. Is vein stand up? No kidding.
The veins from my Johnson, yeah.
Falling on his neck or his head? I mean, what part of it? Which vein? I mean, is it his big vein, you know, on his penis or what? I mean, I don't know what you're talking about.
Huh? It's the head, yeah, the vein on my Johnson's head. They get purple and veiny.
Seriously, we got too many religious fanatics, if you ask me, in the world. You know, I mean, it's too much violence. More, you know, less guns, more sex. That's what I try to tell people. I think Howard Stern said that. Yeah. Well, Howard Stern, you know, he's been on Radio Free Kansas.
Yeah. Howard Stern was looking at my Johnson yesterday.
That's really cool, dude. Hey, man, thanks for calling in. I'm running out of time, but I think between the two of us, we made our point about Mike Johnson, didn't we? Huh?
Well, I had a couple more points about Mike Johnson.
Hurry.
What do you think of Mike Johnson? Honestly.
Well, honestly, he's a religious fanatic, and he knows how to cater to that. I think he's out here in Kansas, they would call him a true believer. He really puts on a good act about being a true believer. So I think that's what I think, man.
My Johnson is sagging, though, kind of in the polls.
Yeah, he is. Well, you know, Donald Trump is not. And Joe Biden, I don't even think he's got one. So, I mean, you know, he doesn't have a Mike Johnson, that's for sure. You can't call Chuck Schumer Mike Johnson.
Well,
so,
have you heard of Big Johnson? I have a Big Johnson.
I had a buddy of mine out in southeast Kansas. His name was Rick Big Johnson. Rick. Everybody called him Rick because I didn't want to call him Big Johnson because, I mean, why give the mofo some credit? I mean, you know, right?
Well, that's actually what I've been talking about this whole time is my Johnson. I wanted to see what you thought about my personal Johnson, my wiener.
Well, I've got a guy, you know, one of my first anonymous callers called in on this show in 2008, and he was a prank caller, and he said, I got my penis in a blender.
Was he telling the truth?
No, I don't give a shit. I mean, I don't think so. I mean, I told him, pull it out. Let's see if I got to do this show, dude. Let's see if I get to play.
Well, so do you have any thoughts about my cock? Or?
No, I don't have any. I mean, you need to go to the Pride Parade. You know, you might find more. You know, might find more interest.
This is Law and Disorder.
Hello? Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with journalist Chris Hedges, who's just returned from Doha and the Rafah crossing in Egypt, where he reported for Al Jazeera on the situation in Gaza. This is the profound insight of a man who's done this for 20 years. We also speak with our dear friend Bill Goodman, who recently passed away. Bill was a partner in a law firm with our co-host Julie Hurwitz and a lifetime partner with Julie as well. He left a legacy of great litigation, which we can all build on.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
I am civil rights attorney Julie Hurwitz.
a partner in the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James, based in Detroit, Michigan, and a board member of the Michigan chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
Israel is a longtime strategic ally of the United States in the Middle East. If you look at a map of the area, Israel is shaped like an aircraft carrier. That's its use to the USA. Israel is given $3.8 billion a year of taxpayer dollars to use to purchase American military weapons. It has just been granted a multi-billion dollar military aid package to facilitate its war efforts. The 2,000-pound bombs being used to destroy the tiny Gaza Strip, making it into a parking lot, are made in the USA. So are Israel's tanks, planes, armored personnel carriers, bullets, grenades, and artillery shells. On October 7th, several hundred young Palestinians of the resistance movement Hamas broke through the fence of besieged Gaza, killing Israelis and taking hostages. This was illegal and inhumane, but understandable given Israel's historical blocking of a peaceful solution. The Netanyahu government used the attack and hostage taking as a pretext, an excuse, to begin a genocidal war against 2.3 million people in Gaza. Their slogan was, "Finish the Nakba," the catastrophe Israel inflicted on Palestinians in 1948. Through their use of murder and terror, they then drove out 750,000 Palestinians and destroyed 531 of their villages. The Zionists took 78% of their land. Now they want the rest. They hope to level Gaza and drive the Palestinians living there across the border into Egypt. The USA is facilitating this process and is complicit in the genocidal war. There may be a paradigm shift in the 100-year war on the Palestinians. We'll speak about this, the situation over there, with our returning guest, Chris Hedges. He's an Arabic-speaking former Middle East bureau chief at the New York Times. Chris Hedges has just returned from Doha, broadcasting on the crisis in Gaza for Al Jazeera, as well as being in Egypt, where he covered the war. Hedges spent 20 years as a war correspondent and reported on the past two Palestinian intifadas, or uprisings. He's a graduate of the Harvard Divinity School and the author of 14 books. Many people consider him not only a journalist, but a moral philosopher. His work can be found at chrishedges.substack.com. Chris Hedges, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Chris, you recently returned from Doha and Egypt. Why'd you go over there and what'd you learn? And please talk about the moving, powerful letter you wrote on the airplane to the children of Gaza.
I was asked by Al Jazeera and Qatar to come to Doha and provide commentary on the assault on Gaza. I spent 7 years in the Middle East. I'm an Arabic speaker. I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. And I spent 10 hours a day over 2 days doing shows and commenting on what was happening. And then I went on to Cairo because I wanted to go to Rafah, the border crossing into Gaza, to lend my voice along with other reporters to call not only for a ceasefire, but of course for an end to the blockade. There are no foreign reporters in Gaza. The only people doing the reporting are Palestinian reporters, many of whom have been targeted, 43 of whom have been killed. The Al Jazeera correspondent, his entire family was killed, and we were blocked by the Egyptian authorities from getting to Rafah. And on the plane, as you mentioned, I sat up all night and wrote this letter to the children of Gaza. I don't want to butcher it. The best way to experience it is to hear Eunice, who's a Juilliard-trained actor, my wife, read it. She just gives it even more emotional power, and you can find that at chrishedges.substack.com, and it's Eunice Wong reading Letter to the Children of Gaza, because, of course, over 50% of the residents of Gaza are children, and some 5,000 have been killed. The numbers of dead and the intensity of the bombing, I think, is sometimes lost on those who haven't experienced a siege. I was in Sarajevo during the war. We were being hit with 300 to 400 shells a day. That was translated into 4 to 5 dead a day, about 24 wounded a day. That's nothing compared to Gaza. And I don't want to minimize Sarajevo. I'm almost 3 decades later. I still have nightmares about it. But we're talking of upwards of 100 children a day, hundreds of people a day. And when they talk about 15,000 dead, we have to remember there are thousands of missing under the rubble, and then probably tens of thousands of wounded.
I read today that between 500 and 700 children have lost their arms or legs, being operated on with no anesthesia, hardly any hospitals left on the strip. It's just unbelievably awful. Chris, war is propaganda mostly. Could you please talk about Israel and American propaganda? The story that Israel put out about Hamas beheading 400 babies, or the tunnels they said that the Hamas had used as a command and control center underneath the Al-Shifra hospital, which thus necessitated the destruction of the hospital, or Israel's President Herzog's statement that all Palestinians are legitimate targets because they're all terrorists. Can you talk about the propaganda, please?
Well, like all settler colonial projects, Israel was founded on deceit and lies. We know that. The private correspondence of Chaim Weizmann, one of the leaders of the original Zionist project, as were the other Zionist leaders, about displacing, removing the indigenous inhabitants from their land and seizing that land. So that duplicity goes all the way back to, you know, after World War I. Rashid Holiday wrote a good book, 100 Years War on Palestine. They knew what they were doing. They've always known what they are doing. But of course, you know, that kind of honesty about what was happening in historic Palestine would have been unpalatable to not only most people in the West, but even supporters of Zionism. So deceit is baked into the system. And I reported from Gaza over 7 years. I would arrive at a place that where Israel claimed that they had carried out a surgical strike, and I would see the bodies of the children. Surgical strikes in crowded refugee camps are an absurdity. You can't drop 1,000, 2,000 pound bombs on refugee camps and not kill large numbers of civilians. And then we would get the lies that would have to be, given the nature of American journalism, fed into the story. And of course, it confuses the narrative. It allows people to believe whatever they want to believe, even though we were there and saw it. So this kind of propaganda is not new. We have repeated examples of Israeli lies, misinformation. You can go back to the bombing of the hospital, the Anglo-American hospital, where 500 were killed, roughly, certainly we don't know the numbers exactly, several hundred were killed, and Israel released pictures of rockets, Hamas or Palestine Islamic Jihad rockets, and then the New York Times found that the timestamp was 40 minutes after the attack on the hospital. So the calendar that supposedly had names, the Israeli actor who pretends to be a Hamas doctor, the ridiculous stories about tunnels, the idea that Al-Shifa Hospital is a command center, it's just kind of endless. But that is baked into the system itself, and something that I experienced during the 7 years that I reported on the Palestine-Israel conflict.
Just after Israel was established, Albert Einstein, Hannah Arendt, and Sidney Hook, three prominent intellectuals in the USA, published a letter in the New York Times warning about the danger of the Israeli government becoming fascist. This was prescient, wasn't it?
Yes, so they were actually writing about a right-wing party that Netanyahu's father belonged to, and they were calling out that party as fascistic. And I think that that strain of Jewish fascism, for lack of a better word, has always been part of the Zionist project. As I hear Jabotinsky, one of the founders of the Zionist state, Benito Mussolini at one point called him a good fascist. When I was living in Jerusalem, you had Meir Kahana, this racist rabbi, calling for violence and expulsion of Palestinians, and his Koch party, which, interestingly enough, was banned by the Israeli government in 1994. He was later assassinated. But what we're seeing in the Netanyahu government are figures who are essentially come out of the Koch party. So there was always this strain, and it was kept in check by these kind of liberal, often Western-educated people like Abba Eban, who went to Oxford, and who I knew, of course, Teddy Kollek and others, and Rabin, Yitzhak Rabin. But that has now triumphed, essentially, within the Israeli political system, which is why we're getting these genocidal statements coming from government ministers. I mean, Bibi Netanyahu is calling the Palestinians the new Nazis. We're going to turn Gaza into a parking lot, etc. So it's really the triumph of this very repugnant strain, which has always been there, of, for lack of a better term, Jewish fascism.
Would you credit the demonstrations worldwide, including in the USA, as being a factor in forcing Israel and America to go along with the temporary ceasefire?
I think that the demonstrations are very important. I participated in some of them, and that's really all the pressure we have, because the immediate response on the part of the Biden administration was not only to support, I think we can correctly call it a campaign of genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza, I mean, including cutting off water, fuel, food, etc., but to veto the ceasefire resolution at the United Nations, to provide more military aid, as we already get $3.8 billion a year in U.S. military aid, and then sending the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, to the Middle East to lobby the governments in Egypt and Jordan and to accept those who would be ethnically cleansed out of the West Bank and Gaza. Now, that failed utterly because the Arab world essentially slammed the door in his face for totally understandable reasons. We saw within the supplemental aid request a line item for resettlement. So the Biden administration is a full partner in what's happening. Of course, it's politically detrimental to Joe Biden, and we've seen that with the poll numbers. But you have to remember that the Netanyahu government could care less, because if they get rid of Biden, they get Trump. So they don't have any stake in Biden's reelection. In fact, they would prefer to get Trump, who is even more obsequious to the dictates of Jerusalem than Joe Biden, although he's pretty obsequious.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm speaking with Chris Hedges on the situation in Gaza. The U.S. demonstrations in support of the Palestinians have been phenomenal. Nothing like it before. How do you explain this?
Well, it's interesting. I've noticed, I've attended a lot of anti-war demonstrations during the 20 years of our military adventurism in the Middle East, and the crowd skews older. That's not true with the demonstrations, at least the ones I've attended. They're primarily young, certainly in their 20s. That was even true in the very large demonstration in Washington. And I think it's caused by a couple of factors. One, a lot of these students, or when they were students, they were more attuned to the nature of colonial settler projects and how they work. They don't trust the mainstream media. It's interesting that the universities have reacted just as they did back in the campaign against the apartheid state in South Africa to denounce the students. And in Colombia, they've banned Students for Justice in Palestine. They've banned Jewish Voices for Peace. They have been quite aggressive in going after those students who have spoken up for Palestinian human rights and against genocide. And that is because, of course, they dance to the tune of their wealthy donors. These presidents have been groveling before these donors who sit on their trustee boards. They don't work for the university. They certainly do not work for the students. And so that wealthy elite, of course, also controls the media, the commercial media. And you've seen very wholesome statements in support of Israel by the owners of MSNBC, CNN, et cetera. So, but I think that this generation has learned correctly to distrust both these media outlets and a power elite that is kind of bonded at the hip with this settler colonial project in Israel. And that, of course, is incredibly heartening, certainly not only for those of us who care about justice in Palestine, but also for a generation that isn't willing to be manipulated or even intimidated by those who back this genocide in Gaza.
It's not possible to wipe out Hamas or the Palestinian resistance, is it? So what would a lasting peace look like?
No, it's not possible to wipe out Hamas. They can wipe out a lot of the leadership of Hamas, as Israel has. I knew two of the leaders of Hamas, Abdelaziz Rantisi and Nizar Rayan, both of whom were assassinated by Israel. And just a couple weeks ago, Rayan's widow, who I also knew, was killed in the bombing. No, Hamas is a resistance movement. I don't want to in any way sound like I'm condoning the atrocities and war crimes that were committed on October 7th, and I would argue committed by the firing of indiscriminate rockets into Israeli civilian areas. These are war crimes. They're not usable, but to understand is not to condone. I mean, we do have to understand. When you trap people in a concentration camp, there's probably no other word used to describe Gaza, over 16 years, and humiliate and impoverish them and shoot them as if they were beasts, even when they carry out like the March of Return, the nonviolent protests. I mean, Israeli snipers were shooting journalists, medics, children, it didn't matter. Then, of course, you get this response. This is how Nat Turner reacted in the slave revolt. It's how in the Haitian liberation movement and C.L.R. James and Black Jacobins, probably one of the best histories of the uprising in Haiti, talks about the cruelty towards the French planters, or even the French Revolution when they were putting the severed heads of clerics and aristocrats on pikes and parading from the streets of Paris. When you treat people with that kind of brutality and violence, especially over a long period of time, then they react that way. But Hamas is not ISIS, although there's been this attempt to equate the two. They're very different. In fact, ISIS thinks of Hamas as apostates. Because, of course, they are wedded to the liberation of Palestine, and ISIS is a kind of super, and I won't get into the details, but they don't converge in any way. So, yes, you can, as Israel has repeatedly, you can eradicate individual leaders, but it's an idea. And, in fact, of course, having just come back from the Middle East, Hamas's stature throughout the Muslim world is immense, given the resistance, given the slaughter that they face, given the overt racism that is used not only to describe them, but describe Palestinians.
Is there a new paradigm in the Middle East? Is there a redeemable liberal Zionism? Is the two-state solution still a talking point? Is the idea that there's a single standard for human rights within the international order, or that the USA government can ever again lecture about the rule of law? Is international law and the UN compromised beyond repair? Has this all been destroyed in Gaza?
I think it's certainly been deeply wounded, if not destroyed, because the message is international law, humanitarian law, Geneva Conventions, they don't matter for us. We don't go by the rules. We can do whatever we want. We can destroy hospitals. We can kill, butcher children. We can starve a population. And those rules don't count. And of course, the Global South is watching this and fully understands. So yes, is there a place for a two-state solution? Not anymore, because Israel has made that impossible, in particular through the settlements and the control of up to 60% of the West Bank. So when you hear the chant from the river to the sea, what we're talking, and which I support, is a secular state where everyone has equal rights. But Israel has made the two-state solution untenable. It isn't going to work anymore. at Liberal Zionism. J Street has signed on for this. Michael, in that J Street does not want a ceasefire, which is a shame because they have done some good work. But I don't see a future for Liberal Zionism because it's a contradiction in terms. If you create a theocratic or a Jewish state where those who are not Jews are second-class citizens at best or live under military occupation, as they do in the West Bank and Gaza. Remember, Israel controls all of the borders of Gaza. It's just an open-air prison. Then you can't have both. So it's a kind of oxymoronic phrase at this point, liberal Zionism.
Yes, I'll say. Thanks, Chris Hedges. Before I say goodbye, please mention your latest book and how people can get in touch with you and keep up with your writings.
The latest book is actually called The Greatest Evil is War, and it's a book of essays where I'm speaking about people, and of course I myself am part of that process, those who have been maimed, wounded, traumatized by war.
Thank you so much for being our guest on Law and Disorder. You take it easy.
Thank you. I was flying from Newark on the way to a connecting flight in Istanbul, and I sat up most of the night and wrote this letter to the children of Gaza. The reason being that for all of us who have covered war, and I've been a war correspondent, I was a war correspondent for 20 years, I think what is the hardest for us to see and cope with is the suffering of children.
Letter to the Children of Gaza is read by Eunice Wong, a member of SAG-AFTRA and Actors Equity Association, www.eunicewong.actor.
Dear child, it is past midnight. I am flying at hundreds of miles an hour in the darkness, thousands of feet over the Atlantic Ocean. I am traveling to Egypt. I will go to the border of Gaza at Rafah. I go because of you. You have never been in a plane. You have never left Gaza. You know only the densely packed streets and alleys, the concrete hovels. You know only the security barriers and fences patrolled by soldiers that surround Gaza. Planes for you are terrifying. Fighter jets, attack helicopters, drones. They circle above you. They drop missiles and bombs. Deafening explosions. The ground shakes. Buildings fall. The dead, the screams, the muffled calls for help from beneath the rubble. Tenday, trapped under the piles of smashed concrete. Your playmates, your schoolmates, your neighbors, gone in seconds. You see the chalky faces and limp bodies when they are dug out. I am a reporter. It is my job to see this. You are a child. You should never see this. The stench of death, rotting corpses under broken concrete. You hold your breath. You cover your mouth with cloth. You walk faster. Your neighborhood has become a graveyard. All that was familiar is gone. You stare in amazement. You wonder where you are. You are afraid. Explosion after explosion. You cry. You cling to your mother or father. You cover your ears. You see the white light of the missile and wait for the blast. Why do they kill children? What did you do? Why can't anyone protect you? Will you be wounded? Will you lose a leg or an arm? Will you go blind or be in a wheelchair? Why were you born? Was it for something good? Or was it for this? Will you be happy? What will it be like without your friends? Who will die next? Your mother? Your father? Your brothers and sisters? Someone you know will be injured. Soon. Someone you know will die. Soon. At night, you lie in the dark on the cold cement floor. The phones are cut. The internet is off. You do not know what is happening. There are flashes of light. There are waves of blast concussions. There are screams. It does not stop. when your father or mother hunts for food or water, that terrible feeling in your stomach. Will they come back? Will you see them again? Will your tiny home be next? Will the bombs find you? Are these your last moments on Earth? You drink salty, dirty water. It makes you very sick. Your stomach hurts. You are hungry. The bakeries are destroyed. There is no bread. You eat one meal a day. Pasta, a cucumber. Soon, this will seem like a feast. You do not play with your soccer ball made of rags. You do not fly your kite made from old newspapers. You have seen foreign reporters. We wear flak jackets with the word press written on it. We have helmets. We have cameras. We drive jeeps. We appear after a bombing or a shooting. We sit over coffee for a long time and talk to the adults. Then we disappear. We do not usually interview children, but I have done interviews when groups of you crowded around us, laughing, pointing, asking us to take your picture. I have been bombed by jets in Gaza. I have been bombed in other wars, wars that happened before you were born. I too was very, very scared. I still have dreams about it. When I see the pictures of Gaza, these wars return to me with the force of thunder and lightning. I think of you. All of us who have been to war hate war most of all because of what it does to children. Tell your story. I tried to tell the world that when you are cruel to people, week after week, month after month, year after year, decade after decade, when you deny people freedom and dignity, when you humiliate and trap them in an open-air prison, when you kill them as if they were beasts, they become very angry. They do to others what was done to them. I told it over and over. I told it for 7 years. Few listened. And now, this. There are very brave Palestinian journalists. 39 of them have been killed since this bombing began. They are heroes. So are the doctors and nurses in your hospitals. So are the UN workers, 89 of whom have died. So are the ambulance drivers and the medics. So are the rescue parties that lift up the slabs of concrete with their hands. So are the mothers and fathers who shield you from the bombs. But we are not there. Not this time. We cannot get in. We are locked out. Reporters from all over the world are going to the border crossing at Rafah. We are going because we cannot watch the slaughter and do nothing. We are going because hundreds of people are dying a day, including 160 children. We are going because this genocide must stop. We are going because we have children, like you, precious, innocent, to live. I hope one day we will meet. You will be an adult. I will be an old man, although to you I am already very old. In my dream for you, I will find you free and safe and happy. No one will be trying to kill you. You will fly in airplanes filled with people, not bombs. You will not be trapped in a concentration camp. You will see the world. You will grow up and have children. You will become old. You will remember the suffering, but you will know it means you must help others who suffer. This is my hope, my prayer. We have failed you. This is the awful guilt we carry. We tried, but we did not try hard enough. We will go to Rafah, many of us, reporters. We will stand outside the border with Gaza in protest. We will write and film. This is what we do. It is not much, but it is something. We will tell your story again. Maybe it will be enough to earn the right to ask for your forgiveness. Letter to the Children of Gaza, written by Chris Hedges, read by Eunice Wong. ChrisHedges.substack.com. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Bill Goodman died in his home in Detroit on November 16th of 2023. He was 83 years old. Bill was the son of Ernie Goodman, who was one of the founding members of the National Lawyers Guild and a partner in the first racially integrated law firm in the United States. Bill was a past president of the National Lawyers Guild, one of the founding officers of the NLG's National Police Accountability Project, the former legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and a founding board member of the Sugar Law Center for Economic and Social Justice. He worked up until his death and was a partner in the Detroit law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz, and James, where he fought for the rights of victims of government and corporate abuse. Bill was also an adjunct professor of law at Wayne State Law School, where he taught constitutional litigation. Bill had successfully litigated numerous police and government misconduct cases, as well as other high-profile cases on behalf of prisoners, toxic tort victims, the wrongfully convicted, and victims of racism, always in the pursuit of constitutional, social, and economic justice. Our co-host, attorney Julie Hurwitz, was Bill's law partner in the Goodman, Hurwitz, and James law firm, and a longtime life partner. They knew each other for many, many years. This interview, which we did last year, Julie will discuss two cases that she and Bill brought to confront the unconstitutional and inhumane conduct of individual police officers, but more importantly, the historically unconstitutional and inhumane ways in which police departments institutionally tolerate, promote, and reward such behavior by their officers. Give a listen.
Bill Goodman, the son of Ernie Goodman, who was one of the original founding members of the National Lawyers Guild, is a legend in his own right. A past national president of the NLG and one of the founding officers of the NLG National Police Accountability Project, the former legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and a founding board member of the Sugar Law Center for Economic and Social Justice, Bill was also a partner in the first racially integrated law firm in the United States back in the 1960s. He is currently a partner in the Detroit civil rights firm Goodman, Hurwitz, and James, where he continues to work tirelessly for the rights of victims of government and corporate abuse. Bill is also an adjunct professor of law at Wayne State University Law School, where he teaches constitutional litigation. Bill has successfully litigated numerous police and government misconduct cases, as well as other high-profile cases on behalf of prisoners, toxic tort victims, the wrongfully convicted, and victims of racism, always in the pursuit of constitutional, social, and economic justice. And full disclosure, Bill is also my law partner in Goodman, Hurwitz, and James, and a former long-term partner in life. We've known each other a long time. Bill, welcome to Law and Disorder.
I'm delighted to be here today.
We are thrilled to be able to interview you today because you have tremendous insight and a lot to share with our listeners. Over the past 5 to 10 years, there has been growing public awareness and acknowledgement of the reality of police abuse and the inherent racism of law enforcement culture in our country. The wide publicity surrounding the police killings of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia, Breonna Taylor in Kentucky, and more recently George Floyd in Minneapolis sparked mass protests in the streets and some minimal superficial reforms in some cities throughout our country. But the racist police violence continues largely unabated. You've been doing this work for decades and are more familiar than most with the long history of police abuse and its legacy of racism in our country. With that in mind, Bill, we'd like to talk with you today about two of the cases you and our firm have taken on that directly confront the unconstitutional and inhumane conduct of individual police officers, but more importantly, the historically unconstitutional and inhumane ways in which police departments institutionally tolerate, promote, and reward such behavior by their officers. So, the first case, Gaddis versus the City of Detroit et al. Can you tell our audience what this case is about and who are the plaintiffs and the defendants?
This case is about a shooting of a man who was at a family gathering one summer night in the city of Detroit. His name is Mark Gaddis, and he was there with his child and visiting his aunt and other relatives in the neighborhood. And the Special Operations Unit of the Detroit Police Department, three police officers, all of whom are defendants in the case, along with the city of Detroit, were cruising and saw the gathering outside and basically disrupted the gathering by charging the crowd, shouting, "Who's got a gun?" And people started to run. They were afraid. The Special Operations Unit car was not clearly designated as a Detroit police car. The cops were all in plain clothes, basically. They were not in police uniforms. And they charged the crowd, and Mark took off running along with the rest of them. He was bigger than the others and noticeable, and they particularly concentrated on chasing him when they got close, shouting all sorts of racial epithets at him and other things. They shot him, and then they later claimed that he had a gun. They found a gun, but I believe they planted that gun, charged him with a crime. Witnesses in the neighborhood all said he had no gun whatsoever. He was charged with a crime, 13 counts, and he was acquitted on each count very quickly by a jury, which believed the civilian witnesses and found that the cops were lying. That's what the case is about.
Bill, what are the legal theories in this case, and how does the evidence pertain to many of the issues we've been hearing and reading and protesting about regarding racist police violence and the institutions that support it?
Well, the legal theory is that they violated his Fourth Amendment rights to be free from unreasonable seizures when they chased him, wrestled with him, struggled with him, fought him, kicked him in the head, and shot him. That's a violation of the Fourth Amendment. That's an unreasonable seizure. In addition, there's the claim that the city of Detroit basically tolerated officers whom it knew were violent, were racist, in so doing encouraged that kind of conduct. That's called a Monell claim against the city of Detroit, and it is particularly striking in this case. Fortunately, Mr. Gaddis was not killed when he was shot, but he was seriously and permanently injured. He cannot sit down without serious pain. And he cannot walk without pain, and he cannot walk normally.
This sounds very much like a Standing While Black scenario. And there are larger issues in this case also, Bill, that relate to the defense of qualified immunity that law enforcement officers and other government employees enjoy widely in our country. Can you please describe for our audience, just very briefly, the elements of the qualified immunity defense and why it is such an important and oppressive doctrine?
Yeah, the elements of a qualified immunity defense is that in order to be liable, a police officer, in this case, a police officer, has to have violated someone's constitutional rights. In this case, it would be the constitutional rights of Mark Gaddis. But not only that right and the way in which it was violated have to have been clearly established at the time they violated that right. So that if there's a case that says, yes, you can't shoot someone who's unarmed while they're running away, then that's a clearly established right. If there's no such case, or a case that says, if you somehow think he's pointing something at you that isn't really a gun but could be a gun, or you're mistaken, and there's no case like that, then you may have a qualified immunity defense, because that's not clearly established, because there's been no written opinion before this happened saying that that is a constitutional violation. And it's outrageous, because the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution simply gives everyone the right to both equal protection, that is, protection from racism, and due process rights, which includes the Fourth Amendment right to be free from unreasonable seizures. And then it says that everyone has that right, and then it says Congress shall have the ability to pass legislation that protects these rights. And in 1871, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act, in which it said anyone who deprives someone of a constitutional right can be liable if they're acting under color of law, that is, if they're a state agent. Now, it doesn't say anything about it being a clearly established constitutional right. It says if you deprive someone of their constitutional rights, you're liable, pure and simple, and period. And by creating this new doctrine of qualified immunity out of nowhere, the United States Supreme Court and the federal courts of this country provide incredible and unreasonable protection for police officers to violate the rights of others. And it's not written in the Constitution, and it's not written in the statute. So this is a judicially created doctrine, and it's outrageous, given the fact that the courts, when they want to, say, oh, no, there's no such a right to choose whether or not to have an abortion. They say that's not in the Constitution, and therefore there's no such right. But when you come to dealing with racism and police violence and police brutality, oh, no, we'll find new doctrines and create them all the time. And that's what qualified immunity is, and it's a huge barrier to people whose rights are continually violated.
Wow. So it sounds to me like what you're describing is what qualified immunity does is it gives cops a free pass to violate someone's constitutional rights.
That's right. There's a free pass until the court says no, which may take a long time.
Today we're speaking with Bill Goodman, the famous civil rights attorney who does police misconduct litigation. Bill, with the current makeup of the federal courts, in particular the Supreme Court, what does the future portend for being able to hold officers and government agencies accountable for blatant law enforcement racism, violence, and conduct that fly in the face of the Constitution?
What I think it portends is a rather severe and prolonged period of constriction of people's rights, and certainly of the right to challenge racism in both overt and implicit bias in police misconduct. That's what I think it portends.
With that in mind, Bill, I'd like to turn our attention to another case that you've been very actively involved in, and that is the case of Detroit Will Breathe versus the City of Detroit. Can you tell our audience what this case is about?
Well, in the city of Detroit, as in cities, communities throughout the United States, shortly after the murder of George Floyd, protesters took to the streets and started challenging police departments in the way in which they enforced the law, in their racism and in their violation of people's rights. And that, starting on May 29th, 2020, an organization of protesters known as Detroit Will Breathe started to organize these protests. And in so doing, the Detroit Police Department responded not with any understanding or even tolerance of the right to freely express one's opinions, but with frequent and varied acts that were both irresponsible and harmful and injurious and dangerous and violated people's constitutional rights. And I can go through the list of what those various kinds of actions were, and we'll do so. But that's what happened. So after May 29th and throughout June, July, August, and into September, these kinds of protests occurred, and the police response was over and over again both violent and even increasingly violent, with the approval of the highest level officials in the city of Detroit, including the mayor, the chief of police, and others.
Bill, Detroit Will Breathe is the Detroit organization equivalent to Black Lives Matter. How was this case born, and what are the theories of liability?
After people were repeatedly injured and had their constitutional rights violated and were seriously injured, the Detroit Will Breathe organization came to the Detroit chapter of the National Lawyers Guild and asked for some help and support. Members of the guild, half dozen or so members of the Lawyers Guild and other members of the legal community, got together, compiled a lengthy complaint, and filed the lawsuit in federal court after the culmination of all of these protests, which was around in September of 2020. So the lawsuit was filed shortly after that.
Bill, can you tell us what some of the significant issues are in this case, and in particular, some of the victories that were won early on in the case?
Well, the issues are, can the police department respond to protests with absolutely irrational or illogical violence, the use of rubber bullets, the use of chokeholds, the use of widespread use of mace and tear gas and batons and beating people. A legal issue that arises out of that is, can a group or a group of protesters who've been injured in these ways get what's called injunctive relief? Can they get a court to say to the city of Detroit, you can no longer do this, you have to stop, you have to tell your officers they cannot use shields and batons to beat people? Those kinds of, that kind of relief. And if you do that, if they continue to do that, you're going to be held in contempt of court. And in fact, the plaintiffs, Detroit Will Breathe, and the individual plaintiffs, people who were injured, got an immediate victory because the judge was so persuaded by the facts that were elucidated in the complaint, along with photographs, that she issued what's called a temporary restraining order, which is a kind of injunction. That later turned into a preliminary injunction, which is still in effect. And since that injunction was entered, the actions of the Detroit Police Department in basically violating the rights of demonstrators and protesters have come to a distinct halt or slowdown, let's put it that way.
So this case has had a significant effect on the willingness of the police to violate the law in Detroit. Great work. Bill, what are some of the discovery issues in the case?
Well, the discovery issues have to do with whether or not emails and text messages of the police officers can be made available and can be seen, whether the names of the police officers can be disclosed. They like to conceal and hide their names. And we have had a lot of success with that. In exchange, however, the defendants in the city of Detroit have been attempting, with some success so far, to get emails from the lawyers and the plaintiffs, the injured parties, to obtain that information, a lot of it having nothing to do with these demonstrations, much of it having to do with the operations of the Detroit Lawyers Guild chapter here in Detroit. So that's very much still an issue and to be decided by the judge.
In addition to those discovery issues, Bill, we've also been able to obtain through court order tens of thousands of hours of body cam and dash cam footage that was generated throughout the summer of 2020 that the plaintiff's team is in the process, as we speak, reviewing and digesting.
Yeah, and much of it is very shocking, I might add.
Can you tell us, Bill, what is the interplay between this litigation and some of the injunctive equitable issues that you've talked about earlier and the larger grassroots movement against police brutality and racism?
Well, the interplay is that if people who are subjected to ongoing racist misconduct by police officers and police departments can obtain judicial oversight by way of injunctions, they can bring an end to at least some of it, as has happened in the Detroit Will Breathe case. An example would be going back to the Gaddis case. This is a situation in which the the special operations unit of the Detroit Police Department is basically cruising black neighborhoods looking for gatherings of people in order to stop them, question them, search them, frisk them, and chase them and shoot them. And this is targeted, as I said, at the black community. If we were able to get the kind of injunctive relief that we've been fortunate enough to get in the Detroit Will Breathe case to stop those kinds of activities, we could somehow impact some of the massive amount of racism that goes into modern-day policing in the United States.
I think to highlight the significance of this case, there was last week a very widely publicized decision made by the Detroit City Council to authorize offering the plaintiffs in this case a significant settlement by way of damages, and it's called an offer of judgment. And I would like you to explain to our audience what is the significance of this development, not only with respect to this case, but in the larger context of the movement, the grassroots movement against police brutality and violence.
Well, this is the city of Detroit initiating an attempt to settle a case, and their initial attempt is in excess of $1 million for all of the various parties in the case. The significance is that it's a huge concession by the city of Detroit that it has been and its police officers have been engaging in widespread misconduct over years and months. In that sense, it's highly significant. How it plays out ultimately has yet to be determined. But the fact that the offer has been put forth by the city is a significant statement of its recognition of its own misconduct, which is unusual. You don't often see that in these kinds of cases.
Bill, what role has the National Lawyers Guild played in this case?
The National Lawyers Guild has played a major role in a number of ways. And first, in all of these demonstrations, there have been National Lawyers Guild legal observers who've been present to help people who encounter the police, either by being arrested or being mistreated in some way, enforce their legal rights. And these legal observers have been at every demonstration, as they have been in demonstrations not only in Detroit, but throughout the United States. Legal observer movement is an important contribution that the Guild has made to mass protests in this country. And in fact, the legal observers themselves have been victims of a lot of police misconduct, and a group of these legal observers have started their own separate lawsuit for both damages and injunctive relief. So I would say that the Guild has played a major role. In addition, all of the lawyers who are involved in the case are members of the National Lawyers Guild and active in the National Lawyers Guild, such as myself and Julie, just as examples.
The police are targeting the legal observers themselves to ostensibly try to cover up what they are witnessing and observing, correct?
Yes, not only to cover up what the legal observers are observing, but to prevent the legal observers from basically assisting other victims of police misconduct from both enforcing and protecting their rights.
In fact, I might add that one of the defenses that has recently been asserted by the city of Detroit is that the legal observers and the DWB activists were in a conspiracy to provoke the police to act violently.
The question is, what is the role of the Guild? It's exactly the opposite of that crazy theory by the city of Detroit that there's a conspiracy. But that's the city of Detroit. They say if you try to protect your rights or help others protect their rights, you're engaged in a conspiracy. That conspiracy is known as the Constitution of the United States.
Bill, thank you so much for your critical work to hold the police accountable and provide a measure of justice for victims of police violence. Thanks for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Pleasure to be on the show. Thank you.
Yes, Bill, thank you so much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Oh, Hello and welcome to the TaxCast, the Tax Justice Network podcast. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm Naomi Fowler. On the TaxCast this month, the story of when the US tax authorities, the IRS, decided to crack down on Microsoft, one of the world's biggest tech companies.
The only ones who benefit here are the big four tax advisors. In this case, tax advisors at KPMG. All of that was very lucrative for them. The downside was suffered by everyone else.
And before that, Titanic power clashes seem to be the order of the day. There's been another historic vote at the United Nations, a landslide vote on how international tax rules are decided. This vote now pushes the world on to the next stage. Here's Alex Cobham of the Tax Justice Network.
Last week's vote at the United Nations was absolutely historic. You know, the countries of the global south came together and demanded that after 100 years in which the imperial powers or their successors at the OECD, the rich countries, have set the rules, that there should actually be a process at the UN to negotiate a convention on tax, international tax cooperation in particular, in which every country in the world will have an equal say, the right to participate fully. So it allows us to look forward to a position where we finally have a global tax body in which every country is represented. Now this is really important for the countries of the global south, starting with the Africa group who've led this. These are the countries that lose the biggest share of their revenues each year to international tax abuse. And that international tax abuse is primarily caused by and facilitated by the rich countries, the members of the OECD, and their dependent territories. But there's also a win here for those OECD countries themselves. They've insisted for so long on keeping the power at the OECD, and it's not just exclusionary there, it's also become completely ineffective. So the OECD members themselves lose, and all of us who are citizens of OECD countries too, of course, lose the greatest amount of revenues in absolute terms to that cross-border tax abuse by their own multinationals, by individuals hiding assets and income streams offshore. So for all of us, the negotiation of the UN Convention that will soon begin is an awesome opportunity to hold our governments to account. Instead of going behind the closed doors of the OECD, people said we'd never get anywhere at the United Nations, that we just had to deal with the fact the OECD was exclusionary and kind of structurally unjust and get the best that we could out of that. I think we've moved on, so let's celebrate just a little, and then the hard work begins.
Yeah, the last time the Global South countries tried to bring decision-making on tax rules to the United Nations was back in the 1970s. Now, 50 years later, they're mounting this existential challenge to global power. In next month's episode, we're going to bring you our analysis of the vote, the attempts by some nations to block it, and we're going to look at what happens next. back to the largest audit in history. It's kind of a United States taxpayers versus Microsoft. And the story doesn't begin where you'd expect. Is the anthem of Humacao. It's an absolutely beautiful location in Puerto Rico, about an hour's drive from the capital city of San Juan. It's got a 3,000-acre nature reserve, lots of beaches, and a population of around 50,000 at the last count, not including all the tourists. It doesn't have an obvious connection to one of the world's biggest multinationals, Microsoft. But since 1989, Microsoft had a little facility there, employing about 85 people to burn Office and Windows software onto CDs. Microsoft had enjoyed a 15-year tax deal with Puerto Rico on this little factory, which guaranteed them a tax rate of 0 to 2%. Over the years, it saved them nearly $200 million in taxes. It's not a huge deal for such a big corporation, but it's nice if you can get it. That nice little 15-year deal was due to end in 2005, but a much more lucrative opportunity came up. This is business reporter at ProPublica, Paul Keel.
They were actually about to close the factory because there was no point in having it there anymore, when essentially KPMG, you know, one of the big four consulting and auditing firms, came to them with a proposal and said, you know, Puerto Rico is actually a great place to have a factory if you have some sort of IP transaction.
IP is intellectual property.
The idea of like a company like Microsoft selling its IP, its most valuable product, particularly to a small company in Puerto Rico, is ludicrous. And, you know, these types of transactions are not unique to Microsoft by any means.
Indeed, they're not. Multinational companies use all sorts of tax strategies to shift their profits to tax havens, and they do it to the tune of an estimated $1 trillion a year. In Puerto Rico, 43% of the population lives in poverty. Not much benefit to be had for them with the Microsoft deal, except for a few jobs, maybe. Anyway, this story's been running for a long time.
20 years. That's how old it is. A long time. It's like a child born, you know, the same year as the transaction is being audited is maybe in college now.
Anyway, KPMG's brilliant idea was for Microsoft to sell its intellectual property to this 85-person factory it owned in Humacao. This time, KPMG persuaded the Puerto Rican government to give Microsoft a tax rate of close to 0%. Microsoft shifted at least $39 billion in U.S. profits there. The IRS auditors discovered what they believed was some mightily creative accounting, some laughable numbers, in fact. Fast forward to 2023, and Microsoft announced the IRS had notified them that they owe $28.9 billion in back taxes plus penalties and interest. Microsoft disputes that.
And they're going to appeal, and that's going to take another good long time.
A very long time. It's a fascinating story. It should be made into a thriller movie someday. Honestly, the twists and turns, the arrogance of Microsoft, the determination of the attorneys working for the IRS. I mean, wow. Anyway, tax authorities don't often challenge multinationals in this way, even in the United States. So how did this even happen?
This is a time when the IRS was actually like relatively well-funded around 2010. You know, Obama's president, they have an IRS commissioner who says he's going to make this a priority. And so they stand up this new unit that's going to audit these sort of transactions more capably. I think it's fair to say there had been some audits before that point, but they had not been particularly, I guess, aggressive in their posture towards how they're approaching the issue. And, you know, clearly back-footed. Like reacting as opposed to making any sort of stand. And so they hired a guy named Sam Maruco, who actually had been a lawyer in private practice. And he was sort of outspoken about the fact that, you know, some of these transactions were clearly a kind of, he didn't use the word tax shelter, but essentially he's saying that's what they are. And that, you know, the IRS had actually gotten on a little bit of a losing streak in auditing his transactions, and he thought the reason for that was that they weren't essentially going about the audits the right way. And he brought over another attorney from the firm he'd practiced at, named Eli Hoori, who was actually pretty young at that time, not that far out of law school. He'd done some work in the private sector, and you know, he also bought into that sort of idea. And so they were canvassing when they got there, 2010, 2011, for cases that they thought would be good, sort of like, let's stand our ground sort of cases.
So, I mean, they had this new unit. It was in the height of some serious money and political will directed at corporate tax abuse. So do you put all this kind of action, which was quite unusual in several different ways, down to political will? Was it public pressure? What do you think spurred that kind of setting up the unit, going quite aggressively after one big multinational?
Right. As for why this happened back in 2010, yeah, I think it was seen as a, you know, having corporations pay their right amount of tax. I mean, these profit shifting like, you know, to Ireland and all these other tax havens, like, you know, that's not popular. People don't like that idea. There's not a lot of defenders of the principle, like why that's good policy. There was a lot of corporations on Capitol Hill saying, you know, we follow the law as it's written sort of thing. But so, yeah, it, you know, I don't know if public pressure is quite the word for it, but I think it was seen as, you know, politically a positive idea. And that was why the IRS had the capital to do that. But I think it also comes down to the personalities of the people who were put in charge of the unit and decided to do things a certain way. Obviously, there wasn't like, you know, the public was not clamoring for them to use these highly obscure tools that the IRS has, and nobody knows about that. It's their choice to decide how to carry out the mandate of, you know, having corporations pay their appropriate amount of tax.
Yeah, I have found before that just a small, quite surprisingly small group of individuals can make a big difference in cases like this and in how tax authorities take action. But I mean, hiring a private corporate law firm to represent the agency, that I don't think that had happened before either, right?
No, it had never. It was a kind of a creative idea they had, which comes back to them being from in private practice and basically like, I mean, frankly, they were not very impressed with the litigators that the government had at their disposal. And basically like we need winners. It's kind of the idea. And yes, there was a big freak out on Capitol Hill about that. And essentially they got into legislation that prevented it from happening going forward. I mean, obviously it's not absolutely necessary for the IRS to have access to private litigators. What is necessary is for them to have capable litigators.
Yeah, it's fair to say as well that if an agency, a tax collection agency, can pay well, then they can retain arguably some of the best people. But I've found many times that you see a lot of people going to the other side because they can earn a lot more money and they're deploying those skills not for the public good, but for corporate good, I guess.
Right. Government salaries are not what you can earn in the private sector. So essentially you're always, it's not like they're paid poverty wages. Like you can get paid quite well by normal standards, but not by like, you know, working for a big four accounting firm standards. So the pitch is always like a public service sort of pitch. Or if you want to be less public service oriented, you know, there is value to having worked at the IRS if you want to go back in the private sector and, you know, you can maybe get paid a little bit more because of that experience. So they are trying to staff up. It's going to take time.
So the reaction of the big tech companies to this challenge from the IRS was really, really strong. And they actually managed to lobby enough to get a change in the law restricting the ability of the IRS to use some of the same tactics in future. This reaction, and I mean, in lots of ways, it shows you how these very big corporations will act as one when it's in their collective interest.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, the lobbyist argument on Capitol Hill is never, you know, we want to make sure that our big tech companies can send profits to tax havens. That's not the way they frame their argument. It's always, you know, taxpayer rights. You don't want the IRS basically being unfair and how it audits people. So, you know, this unit That was one of their cases, and Microsoft was the big one. And so one of the tools they have is called a designated summons. And essentially what it is when a taxpayer is not being forthcoming with documents, they've not given them over in the typical process where the IRS asks for documents and they can stall or whatever, and then it's up to the IRS to sort of take a stand. You know, it's kind of more conventional to issue a normal summons, which would just be you sue them in court and say, give me the documents. But the problem with that is the statute of limitations is still running. So you're going to, with the clock running out on you, it gives incentive to the taxpayer to, you know, drag their feet a little bit. Designated summons stops the clock. So that takes away leverage that the taxpayer has in that situation, because instead of being able to run out the clock, they have to just sort of fight it out in court however long it takes. And that's essentially what happened in this case.
There's an internal appeals process where there's an independent private check on audit findings. Some call the Office of Appeals the gift shop, because complex transfer pricing audits looked at there end up reducing the amount of tax originally owed by about 81%. Microsoft was keen to move straight to that process for obvious reasons. The IRS tried to block that avenue and go straight to an open public court. No doubt they were cheered by frustrated IRS auditors everywhere who faced armies of corporate lawyers in other cases.
People who I spoke to were auditors, often very frustrated with appeals, essentially giving cases away that took years to build. On the appeals side, they have this idea of they have to weigh the litigation hazard, which is another thing. How likely is the IRS to lose in court? And they would come to the conclusion, we're probably not going to win. Maybe there's a 20% chance to win. Therefore, we'll mark down, you know, the adjustment to 20% of what the IRS is wanting. Like, that sort of logic. And so they're particularly worried about doing all this work, building this great case, and then appeals is like, well, transfer pricing case, we don't win, so we'll just give it away. So they thought to skip appeals, and that was one of the big things they fought over.
Microsoft won that particular boxing round and got its internal appeal. And from now on, new legislation will make it harder for the IRS on that front. That's because this huge lobby of tech and business groups lobbied hard. And to cut a long story short, a bill was passed into law, meaning the IRS will have to follow a new process if they want to block appeals or designate summons. And when they do, they'll have to report directly to Congress.
You know, lobbyists for the corporate world and for wealthy taxpayers are good at making arguments in a way that emphasize the taxpayer rights aspect of things. So you end up with bills that are like called the Taxpayer Rights Act or that sort of thing, when oftentimes they're picking issues that really only affect like the largest corporate taxpayers, but oftentimes they'll try to characterize them as hurting small business. So that's what you're up against if you're supportive of, you know, more muscle behind the tax administration.
However, in one of the big victories so far for the IRS in this long-running case, a judge agreed with the IRS's view on Microsoft's use of Puerto Rico. He wrote in his judgment, quote, "The court finds itself unable to escape the conclusion that a significant purpose, if not the sole purpose, of Microsoft's transactions was to avoid or evade federal income tax," close quote. And he agreed with the IRS that documents from accountancy firm KPMG had to be turned over because they'd been promoting a tax shelter. And when you see these documents, you can see why Microsoft fought so hard to keep them confidential.
So there's privilege similar to this attorney-client privilege that, you know, an investigative agency can't get to, or a litigant. Same thing with tax advice. But in cases where, you know, court decides there's a tax shelter, those privileges get rolled back. And essentially that's what the IRS successfully argued in this case.
We know that these kinds of corporate tax schemes are zero-sum. Actually, more than that, you know, this case shows they are a negative-sum game in which nobody really wins.
This is Zorka Millin of the Financial Accountability and Corporate Transparency Coalition.
So in this case, you know, take the people of Puerto Rico, where Microsoft barely paid any taxes, and they didn't even create a meaningful number of jobs. And Puerto Rico, you know, that it's one of the poorest parts of the U.S., and it's also increasingly hit by, you know, climate impacts, like the tragic Hurricane Maria a few years ago. So, you know, in Puerto Rico, disaster relief and other basic public services are desperately needed. And let's not forget the U.S. Treasury. I mean, you know, the U.S. obviously suffered a gigantic, maybe even record-breaking revenue loss, which they're now trying to recover from Microsoft. And also, if we think about Microsoft's investors, they stand to lose. Certainly, if the IRS is successful, that would be a huge hit to the company's bottom line, even for a company that's as huge as Microsoft. And so, really, the only ones who benefit here are the big four tax advisors. In this case, that would be the Microsoft tax advisors at KPMG who came up with this plan and managed to convince Microsoft's executives to go along with it. And they also negotiated the controversial tax holiday with Puerto Rico. All of that was very lucrative for them. There was no downside. You know, the downside was suffered by everyone else.
Indeed. Like tax authorities in many nations, the IRS was financially undermined for years. Soon after coming into office, President Biden injected huge amounts of money, and with the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA, more investment was promised.
The funding is very important for the effort to rebuild the IRS after over a decade of budget cuts.
This is Samantha Jacoby of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
The IRS budget, its sort of annual budget that it gets every year, is about 20% below what it was in 2010 after you adjust for inflation. So there was a sort of a deep hole that the IRS was in before the Inflation Reduction Act passed. And kind of the whole idea behind it was to get the IRS back to where it would have been without those cuts.
The Biden administration was estimating that this new IRS investment should raise $400 billion over the next 10 years. You know, if you look at what the IRS can do when it's very, very determined and you've got a lot of political will, and I'm just thinking about the Microsoft case at the moment, and I know that they're appealing, but it just shows that with the right amount of funding that comes from very strong political will and belief in the tax authority as a public good, it can achieve a lot of things for the public, right?
Yeah, so it is clear that with adequate funding that the IRS can take on some of these large high-impact cases and bring in a lot of revenue. And you mentioned the Treasury estimate on raising $400 billion in revenue. There are some academics out there who think that would be even higher, that return on investment would be even higher. There's a study that found that for every dollar the IRS spends on auditing very high-income taxpayers, the government gets back $12 in revenue. So that's a huge return on investment, whereas audits of low and middle class households raise far less. And, you know, without those resources, it's clear that the IRS just doesn't have the capacity to take on those kinds of cases. The audit rates for millionaires and the largest corporations over the last 10 years fell by roughly 77% and 56% respectively from 2010 to 2017. The reason that happens is tax returns of high income and high wealth people and large businesses are just, they're so complex. Auditing them is labor and time intensive. And so without resources, without the sophisticated audit staff, the IRS just can't do it. They're just not equipped to sort of even identify those high impact cases, let alone pursue them and take on the corporation's sophisticated tax advisors in court. But even, you know, even just a year into the Inflation Reduction Act funding taking effect, the IRS has already shown what it can do. The Microsoft case, of course, predated the IRA, but the IRS has been very effective so far in using the new funding, both to improve the services that it provides taxpayers, as well as, you know, its technology improvements and even making investments in enforcement. So in terms of customer service, they made huge improvements over the last filing season in terms of improving the level of service that they've provided to taxpayers, that people have been, you know, getting their calls answered more quickly. The IRS has has opened new taxpayer service centers to help people file their returns. They've made big improvements in digitizing the tax return filing process. On the enforcement side, they've announced a big new initiative to audit partnerships. Partnerships, particularly large partnerships, are really, really difficult to audit. And the IRS has historically almost never audited large partnerships. The audit rate was practically zero. But they've announced that they're going to start using AI tools to identify partnerships for audit. And those types of entities include hedge funds, large real estate firms that are the really sophisticated entities that are able to sort of structure their businesses so that it's really difficult to unpack where their income is. And so that's one area we're seeing improvement already just a year in. There's been efforts to pursue high income people who have not filed their taxes or failed to pay their tax debts. Those efforts are already starting to pay returns as well.
You'd think that's something all politicians could get behind, but sadly that's not the case. The Republicans are proposing to cut the vast majority of what remains of the $80 billion Inflation Reduction Act funding. Paul Keel again.
I mean, it was pretty apparent to me from the beginning that money would be under threat politically for the entirety of its life. And that's, you know, what we're seeing now. I mean, the Republicans have tried, it's like a routine now, like every single bill, they try to take away money from the IRS. And, you know, if we end up with an election where you have completely Republican-controlled government, I think you have to expect them either gutting that pot of money or simply saying, like, the IRS gets no money. There are normal annual appropriations that are going out. They could just say, like, you just use that pot of money to do that. We're not going to give any more. And that'll be a threat for the length of this bill. So unfortunately, the idea was to give the IRS this pot of money that couldn't be touched and so that they could hire people with confidence. But given the political environment, it's kind of impossible to entirely accomplish that. So it's something that's going to unfortunately have to be watched going forward.
Samantha Jacoby.
It is very disappointing to see efforts to rescind that funding. For context, the IRS budget in 2023 was about $12 billion. So just that annual IRS budget would be cut by a significant amount. And then they would also rescind the vast majority of the long-term $80 billion in funding that Congress passed last year in the Inflation Reduction Act. So if those funding cuts were enacted, that would prevent the IRS from undertaking its planned rebuilding efforts, just sort of full stop. It would cement in place the current depleted state of the IRS after a decade of cuts. And the result would be continued dysfunction, understaffing, declines in the number of audits of the wealthy and corporations on top of what we've already seen. It hasn't been passed yet, and you know, President Biden would, of course, have to approve it. So we're still very optimistic that the IRS will retain most of its funding.
Oh, I hope so. I mean, can he veto it then as president?
Yeah, so the president has veto power over it, and so and the Senate Democrats are in control, and they've been supportive of IRS funding as well. So. But it's unclear where we'll end up, but there's good reason to think that the vast majority of the funding will stay in place.
Let's hope so. Meanwhile, pressure's building on multinationals themselves from shareholders and investors who want to see much more transparency on tax. Zorka Millin again.
In the last couple of years, we've seen increasing demand for tax transparency, in particular coming from investors in a number of major companies. And that includes big oil companies, Exxon, Chevron, ConocoPhillips. In all of those companies, Oxfam America has filed shareholder resolutions. And it also includes big tech companies. Notably, let me single out Microsoft itself. So at Microsoft, the shareholder resolution for country-by-country reporting will be put to a vote again at their upcoming AGM, which is taking place next month. When this happened last year at the AGM, this tax proposal was interesting. It actually had the greatest support out of any shareholder proposal that was put up for a vote last year. And so, you know, it's clear we're seeing an upward trend here. And at this point, I would say really it's just a question of when and not if. And it's also, you know, a question whether it will come as a result of shareholder resolutions or maybe eventually we expect to see a more broadly applicable regulation that would come from the U.S. financial regulators, so the Securities and Exchange Commission.
And like so many of these messes we report on the TaxCast, things don't have to be this way.
Okay, just imagine a world in which Microsoft had published all of its country-by-country tax information for all of the relevant years here. You know, maybe they did it voluntarily, as, you know, some other companies have actually already been doing for many years. Or maybe they did it because of a shareholder resolution that was successful. Or maybe they were just following the law, you know, complying with a regulation that required all companies to provide this tax information. Whatever the reason, if that information was made public, then Microsoft's investors would have spotted right away the incredibly striking mismatch that exists between Microsoft's, you know, pretty insignificant operations in Puerto Rico versus the many billions of dollars in tax profits that the company had booked in Puerto Rico. And that would be a major red flag. And I think that would most likely deter a company like Microsoft from engaging in such very aggressive tax dodging. So in that sense, you know, tax transparency is like sunshine, as they say. It's the best disinfectant.
Currently, the situation is that under OECD rules, companies report the nature of some of the actual business they do country by country, but that system's really deficient in its current form, as Zorka Millin explains.
The OECD regime for country-by-country reporting, it is somewhat helpful. At least it's helpful to those tax officials from those governments who can access it. And it's important to note here that that doesn't include most Global South countries. So, you know, for them, it's not really helpful at all.
And many poorer nations need it the most because corporate tax is even more important to their tax base than in wealthy countries. There's another fundamental problem.
The larger point I would make here is that the OECD, it's not really a transparency regime. I think that's a misnomer because it's not public. So, you know, I don't think we can call something that's not public. I don't think that's real transparency. And so it also means that this is of no use to investors. But, you know, while we're waiting for regulatory action in the U.S. and maybe also the U.K., we actually already have some good news coming from Australia. We recently received a confirmation from a senior Australian government official from the Australian Treasury, Andrew Lee.
And here he is. Listen carefully. He's talking about public country-by-country reporting, very different.
Australia is committed to public country-by-country reporting to hold large multinationals to account when it comes to their tax affairs. Country-by-country reporting is intended to shift behaviour in the way large multinationals disclose their tax information. It puts the onus on multinationals to be upfront about where they pay tax. Australia plans to start our public country-by-country reporting regime on the 1st of July 2024, aligning with the start date for the European Union's regime. Our aim is to be world-leading in country-by-country reporting, and we've consulted on it earlier this year. There's broad stakeholder interest, and we're considering feedback on compliance costs and alignment with other international standards. We want Australia's transparency commitments to be measured and targeted. It's about encouraging a race to the top in business productivity, not a race to the bottom in tax compliance.
This should be good news. We're cautious because the Australian government was on the point of passing this legislation in its parliament earlier this year with a comfortable majority, but it faced a tidal wave of opposition and lobbying, and they delayed it. The OECD, along with many others, lobbied strongly to stop this legislation that would have delivered the biggest breakthrough ever on the taxes of multinational corporations. That proposed Australian legislation would have affected at least one in five of them around the world, and they'd have had to start publicly disclosing their profits and taxes. Zorka Millin again.
Australia plans to start its public, so true transparency, public country-by-country reporting next year, 2024. And that day, that's going to be a sea change in corporate tax transparency. And it will have major global impact that goes far beyond just Australia, because the scope of the laws is such that it will cover many major multinationals. And we also hope that it will cover all of their global operations. So that will be a major moment next year.
It would make such a difference. So let's hope Australia is now back on track with its commitment to public country-by-country reporting. I had one last question for journalist Paul Keel of ProPublica, who's stuck with the Microsoft story for so long. In my job, where I'm trying to communicate these kind of long-term battles that are going on, trying to explain to people some of the things that go on behind closed doors, some things which seem quite boring in some ways and are not easy to explain or understand. I was just wondering what your take on it was, because you've been following this case and cases like this for a long time, such a long historical curve in a case like this. Just wondering about your thoughts on the capacity of media and journalists to reflect to people this type of very important case.
Right, right. I mean, it's complex and not complex. It's not complex in the sense that it's apparent Microsoft did a somewhat ridiculous transaction just to pay a lot of taxes. So people can get that. I mean, I made an effort. I mean, I was writing my story. I did this big story back in 2020. You know, that was for a general audience. And, well, first of all, I think the secrecy around tax administration is one thing that is sort of a hindrance. Like, it's just really hard to write about this in a way that's engaging at all, because there's so little public detail. And the only thing that made it possible for me to write that story was this fight that they had in court of this summit. And not only does that make a lot of stuff public that wouldn't otherwise be public, but also the IRS and the Department of Justice are making arguments to a district court judge who's not a tax judge. And so they're writing in a way that is geared towards a smart lay person as opposed to a tax judge. Like, if you read pleadings in tax court, I mean, I've covered this stuff for a while now. I'm not a tax lawyer. It takes a while to get through, like, what are they even saying here, right? Because they're just throwing statutes around and things like that. So it was only because this kind of rare case spilled into public view that I was able to write, you know, a story that people could follow. A lot of times it just happens. You see the result. The only reason you see the result is if it's a public company and they'll just say, like, what had happened, but they're allowed to keep those details quite secret. And that aspect has never really made a lot of sense to me, is you have public companies that are divulging all sorts of details to investors, but their taxes, they have a lot of leeway. Their taxes are secret, essentially. Their tax return is, like, sanctified. Like, you can't know that. But here's hundreds of pages of financials about this company. It's, like, sort of ridiculous. So I think that is actually another aspect of it, is there's so few stories to tell because everything is secret. So, I mean, the idea is broadly popular of corporations paying more in tax, the rich paying more in tax, but the details are obscure to the point where it's hard to sort of engage the public on it, I think, is one big aspect of it. Microsoft, it's a big, complicated case. It's going to be an appeal. It's going to be private. It's going to be outside of the public eye. And then if Microsoft does not get the answer they want in appeals, then they will go to tax court, which is public, and that itself will take more time. So, there's always more to be done, and you just have to fund the agency and have and hire capable people, you know, good things can happen.
Yes, they can. You've been listening to The Tax Cast from the Tax Justice Network. Next month, we'll bring you a fly-on-the-wall, blow-by-blow account of that historic vote at the United Nations to completely change how global tax rules are decided. We'll look at the attempts to block it and the politics behind the votes for, against, and the abstentions. For more TaxCasts, go to www.thetaxcast.com. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.